20 years after 9/11, the nation remembers. And for those of us, including me, who were hit with the rubble of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, it is a profound anniversary. A candid conversation tonight. And what of the millions and millions of Americans too young to remember or not yet even born in September of 2001? Tonight, their perspective on the country we are leaving them. Plus the CEO, whose entire company was wiped out in the attack on the North Tower. Two NYPD officers who survived that day and reflect now on police in America and how they're regarded 20 years later. All of that on this special edition of Banfield. Hello and welcome to Banfield. As anniversaries pass, more and more Americans will have no personal recollections of 9/11. But those who do, and that is still a large majority, are tied to that horrific turning point in only two possible ways. Some of us were part of it, touched by it directly. And when I say that, I do include myself. I was reporting from Ground Zero live for MSNBC when it looked as though the very world around me was ending.
Please be careful of your baby. Oh my God. Look behind us. Please pan in this way. Please be careful of your baby. This is it.
That's the building coming down.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. No. No. Listen. We'll be all right. We'll be all right.
We're okay. I think we're okay. Actually, I think we're okay.
All right. We're going to have to move this way. We're going to have to move. We're going to have to move. That cloud is coming this way.
Yeah.
Without question, I'm certainly not a hero, but I really did meet a lot of them that day. And some of them are on the program tonight. The rest of the nation and the world, with living memories of September 11th, lived it from a distance. And I won't say a safe distance, because nothing felt safe that day.
That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center.
At this point, we know it happened about 9 o'clock Eastern time. We've heard reports either 737 or 727 crashing into the tower there. It's a 110-story building.
It appeared to bank sharply and smash directly, perhaps purposefully, into, oh my goodness.
Oh God.
There's another one.
Oh.
Oh my goodness, there's another
this
one.
This seems to be on purpose.
Oh my goodness,
another
now it's obvious, I think, that there's a second plane just crashed into the World Trade Center.
I'm going to join you in 1 second. We're listening to the president.
Unfortunately, we'll be going back to Washington after my remarks. Today, we've had a national tragedy.
We have certainly heard reports that another plane had been hijacked, a third plane in all, we now understand, and that there had been an explosion at the Pentagon.
It appears that an aircraft of some sort did hit the side of the Pentagon, the west front, which faces sort of toward Arlington National Cemetery. It's a corridor where a lot of Army offices are located.
Wow.
And some
Jamie,
people were...
Jamie, I need you to stop for a second. There has just been a huge explosion. We can see a billowing smoke rising. And I can't, I'll tell you that I can't see that second tower.
It's actually fascinating to watch that collection of video, because 20 years later, some of that is still new to me. I actually can't believe I'm seeing some of that for the first time, because when all of that reporting was coming to you, I was running down to the World Trade Center. Much like all of you, I saw those first reports of the World Trade Center being hit, but I lived in Manhattan and I worked for a news network, and so my natural instinct was run, go, you got to go cover this. But it was very hard to get there. Subways had all shut down. I luckily found a cab driver who would drive me to southern Manhattan, but not all the way. He stopped around Houston Street, which if you know New York, you'll know it's a long way away from the World Trade Center, and said, I'm not going any further. So I ran on foot and eventually got towards the Trade Center as the North Tower was coming down. That was the second tower to come down. First tower to be hit, but second tower to come down. And I was looking straight up at it. So had to crane my neck all the way back to actually see that tower come down, only realizing within seconds it's coming down here. And hit with the cloud of debris in complete blackness. You can see the black shirt I'm wearing. I took the the sweater that was around my shoulders, and I tied it around my mouth so that I could breathe. And that was what got me through those initial few minutes of a midnight black cloud. And debris that I could feel my ears bending. Smashed the lower part of a window at the closest building I could feel my way to, dived underneath, and got into a vestibule. Shortly thereafter, I actually saw a figure outside that vestibule, and for an instant thought, if I open that door, I'm going to die, and if I don't open that door, he's going to die. Opened the door, pulled him in, and a lot of that cloud came in with him, and it was a World Trade Center security guard. And then a second figure, again, showed up and did it again, and it was a New York City police officer. So in that vestibule of basic protection, right in the middle of that cloud, that's where I rode out the next, I don't know, maybe 10, 20, 30 minutes, while on a flip phone reporting for MSNBC that the apocalypse seemed to have hit us. I'm not sure. I think the controller may have some pictures of that moment in that vestibule where I'm trying to choke through the smoke, and you can see the picture of the flip phone. But it's the moment directly after the cloud lifting. And this is what it looked like. This is what it looked like. It looked like a moonscape. It looked like, you know, the zombie apocalypse. I hate to say it, but this is really what it looked like. And it looked as though, on that, look at that flip phone. That's me reporting what had just happened for MSNBC. And you saw the World Trade Center security guard just off to the left of that picture. And if you squeeze to the right of it, you could have seen the New York City police officer. There's Dan Abrams at the time from NBC talking to me down at Ground Zero. Obviously, the dust has shaken off a lot at this point. It's many hours later. Rick Sanchez, another reporter from NBC, reporting with me, again, many hours later. This is us trying to figure out how to get a signal up. Just get a signal. Go. We've got to get out somehow. Use a phone. Do whatever it takes. There's the right-hand side is the New York City police officer. The left-hand side is the World Trade Center security guard. But that was my experience that day. I've recounted it many times. In fact, I get interviewed all the time on the anniversary of 9/11. And here we are. For the first time, I'm actually telling it on my own show, which is very strange to talk about the experience and what it was like. But here's what is maybe even more unbelievable. As it happens, a colleague of mine, who is the senior broadcast producer of this show, he was a public affairs officer at the Pentagon in 2001. And on the morning of September 11th, American Airlines Flight 77 slammed into the outermost ring of that building, just 100 feet from his desk. He not only had the wherewithal to somehow escape that, survive it, get out with his life, but he also saved the lives of many others. And for that, he was awarded the United States military's highest honor for a civilian. His name is David Thayall, and I never even knew that we shared this extraordinary, bizarre, and unique September 11th experience, Dave, until just recently. So I've been able to persuade him to let somebody else take the reins of the show for just a few minutes so that we can talk a little bit about this story. I think you have the same sense. It's not always easy to tell about what happened on 9/11. It might get easier and easier, and then bam, you get hit with a 20-year anniversary. Talk to me.
Sometimes it seems like 2 weeks ago. Other times it seems like 100 years ago. It's just weird to think that it was 20 years ago. Probably like you, I've had perhaps call it the luxury of hiding behind a camera, of hiding behind a control room wall to look at September 11th without fully immersing myself into the emotions of that day. And before that, I worked at the Pentagon. There was a job to do the morning after the attack, and I, along with thousands of others, lined up to get back to work at the Pentagon. So in many ways, I sort of hid behind my work at the Pentagon, and I've hidden behind control rooms and cameras for the last 20 years or so also.
And you're not telling that, you know, the audience, the big story. I met you because I found you as Larry King's executive producer and begged you to come and work on this show. And here you are, and then found out about this experience. You have a profound memory of the very few moments before the impact of the plane, which was extraordinary, and then the moments after. Can you walk me through that?
We knew what happened in New York. We had a big event that we were getting ready for in the Pentagon when I was working in media relations at the Pentagon. We had a big event that we were getting ready for, like everybody else. We heard the chatter of the first plane hitting the tower. We gathered around televisions. We saw the second plane hit. And like everybody else, we knew that this was something different. I'd gone back down to my office to close out the what I was working on, and a friend called from nearby Fort Belvoir, about 10 miles south of the Pentagon. And she jokingly said the Pentagon's probably next, and it simply couldn't have been timed any better. We could hear the airplane approach. There's just an atmospheric change that happens when a full throttle jumbo jet is in the neighborhood. And I could hear it crash. I could hear the explosion. I could hear the walls crumbling as it was coming for me. My friend had heard me say a cuss word that she had never heard me use before, when it was just an explosion that ripped through my office. A wall landed on top of me that protected me. The fireball passed over me and killed people who were behind me. There were about five people who died within 40 or 50 feet of me. But I remember each sound distinctively as it was coming toward me, even though it's probably a time immeasurable in real time.
You know, looking at these pictures, it's hard to believe, David, that you got out at all, but you did, and you rescued a number of people, which is just so remarkable. Can we show the I know you're going to have to call for it because you're actually working in the control room right now, but can we show the picture and ask Mel, our director, to this one?
That
this
video
is a woman
you're looking
being
at now.
Yeah.
Correct. There was a woman that was brought to us. We started afterwards when we got out of the Pentagon. Finally, there was a triage area, just a makeshift triage area that we all fell upon, and we were helping the victims as they were being pulled out. There's even an image of Don Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld, carrying a litter himself. That is me, who had just loaded a victim up. I turned to see this person, and it was like a war zone with all of the various injuries around, and we literally were just triaging people. I have no medical experience, but I was telling people I knew who needed help and who could wait a little while. And I turned around, and there was a lady on a litter board that had these remnants on her that I just wasn't comprehending. I couldn't understand it. She was bald, for her hair having burned off. There were these remnants on her body, but she had this most serene look on her face. And it took me a second to realize that this is a person who had been burned. Her hair had been burned off. Her clothes had been burned off. Her skin had been burned off. And the look of serenity on her face just wasn't matching what I was looking at. And I remember stopping in that moment with this war zone happening around me and saying, this is a woman who was meeting her creator. I have never seen a look of serenity like that. And it just wasn't jiving with the body that I was seeing. And we covered her with the sheet, and I just kept telling her, it will be okay, it will be okay. And that is the lady that you see us loading into the helicopter, and she was not okay. Antoinette is her name, and she died of her injuries.
Antoinette Sherman. And you met her family years later, but it took you years to be able to approach them to say, you know, that you were with her when she was being evacuated. That must have been just heart-wrenching.
I tried repeatedly. On the one-year anniversary, I set a couple of rows behind them. On the second-year anniversary, I set a couple of rows behind them. And I simply just wanted to go up and introduce myself and tell them about this look of serenity that I had seen on her face. And I physically couldn't do it. I physically could not get my legs to move in their direction. There was something that was just blocking me. And then when I got within 10 feet of them, I literally couldn't get the words out of my throat, because it just, my throat had swollen shut. And it took me a couple of years before, on one of the anniversaries, I went to Antoinette's bench in the Pentagon Memorial Park. And I simply sat and waited for them to show up. And I recognized her because she looks just like her daughter. And I stood up and I introduced myself and I told them the story. And I asked their forgiveness for taking so long to tell them. And they immediately forgave me. And 20 members of Antoinette's family, cousins, her mother, her foster child, enveloped me in this hug, and we just all sat there crying over the memories of Antoinette.
You know, David, it's hard to believe here we are 20 years later, having this conversation live on air from the control room, you know, to the anchor set. And I was struck by a statistic that, you know, Jim Guthrie, one of our producers, found, and that is that 1,106 people were never identified. Lost that day, but they never had that moment where they could bury their loved one like they were able to bury Antoinette. And I'm just wondering, you know, for you on that day, you're such a positive person. I saw hell and you saw the best of America. And I'm just wondering 20 years later, if you feel the same way that you felt on 9/11, which was this is the best of us in the worst of times.
It was the darkest moment of our country, perhaps. And I did. I saw the best of humanity that day. I've told you this before, that it was in that moment, that day. It didn't matter if you were a Republican or a Democrat. It didn't matter if you were a gay or born again. It didn't matter if you were of Muslim descent or Irish descent. It simply didn't matter. All I saw was the best of humanity. I saw humans running into fire to save other humans. I saw the absolute, I saw bravery, I saw the best of humanity that day, and it has sustained me for low these 20 years, that no matter what happens in our country, and these last couple of years has been rough to remember that lesson that I learned that day, admittedly, but I still think that we are going to be okay, because I saw what we can do as humans, as Americans, that day.
You know what, David, you work every 9/11, you do these shows, you know, you're in work mode every 9/11 like I am. Have you ever actually stopped down to be in victim mode, or at least in remembrance mode, or in, you know, America mode, the way everybody else looks at 9/11?
I attend the ceremonies. Each year I get invited to participate in the ceremony at the Pentagon. The first year anniversary was amazing because, if you'll remember, they were determined to have those offices open, those offices that were ruined on September 11th. They were determined to have rebuilt that day, and they did. On the one-year anniversary, there were people looking out of windows that were destroyed a year earlier in new offices watching the one-year ceremony. September 11th, I usually go for a run in the morning. I like to have a quiet morning September 11th. I will go for a run, as I say, for those who are no longer able to run. Just that sort of sets the day for me. And then I just let the day wash over me. Sometimes it's sad. Sometimes it's this happiness to see when you're reunited with somebody from that day, when you get to catch up. But I don't think that there's any one way to do it. For me personally, I do my morning run for those who can't, and then I just let the day wash over me however it is going to wash over me.
Yeah, I turn out I turn off the TV a lot, I have to say. You know, that's really what I do. But, you know, I'm really glad we were able to do this and to just have this moment at work while we're at least recognizing the significance of this two-decade milestone. So I'm going to ask you to go back to work, if you wouldn't mind, so that we can continue on in the program. Thank you, David Thayil. I really appreciate you, you know, making the effort to tell us this story.
You got it. My pleasure.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. So when we come back, you know, the post 9/11 generation is something else. What do they think? We've left them this world, right? Did we leave them a good world? I don't know. 20 years later, I'm worried. You're also going to meet the CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald. He had over 300 employees at work that day, but he took his child to kindergarten, and every single member of his office was killed. We're going to talk about the things that he's done and the children of the dead who are now working for that company. He joins us next.
United 175, New York. We have some problems over here right now. We might have a hijack over here, two of them.
American 11, are you trying to call?
The doctor is not answering their phone. Our number one has been stabbed, and our five has been stabbed.
United 93, have you got information on that yet?
Yeah, he's down.
He's down?
Yes.
When did he land?
He did not land.
The carnage inflicted by those four hijacked airliners a full 20 years ago was felt nowhere more keenly or cruelly than on the New York brokerage firm Cantor Fitzgerald. Cantor occupied the 101st through 105th floors of One World Trade Center. And on the morning of September 11th, 659 Cantor employees were killed. That is every Cantor employee who came to work and was at the New York office at the time. CEO Howard Lutnick was not there because he was taking his son to his first day of kindergarten. Somehow, amazingly, Cantor resumed its business along with the rest of Wall Street just 2 days later. Rebuilding, though, took years. Lutnick started with Cantor itself. He didn't end it there, though, because for 5 years, Cantor paid a quarter of its profits to the families of the workers who were killed and paid for their health care for 10 years. And now on each 9/11 anniversary, the firm invites celebrities to work the phones, and 100% of the revenues on that day go to charity. Howard Lutnick is kind enough to join us. Thank you so much for being with us. Howard, your own brother was among those who died that day. So many of your friends as well. I can't imagine what every anniversary has been like for you, and especially this particular one.
It's a tough time of year for me. I mean, there's no other way to say it. I stay focused. I need to be together with the families of my friends and all of those that we lost. We read their names. We talk about them. We remember them. But we're all together. And then that night, we have charity day. I spend all day raising money for the families and now for 150 other organizations. And then that night I go out with my best friend's widow, which I always do every September 11th.
How do you remember your own brother, Gary? Because it's one thing to, pay tribute to all of the employees you lost, which is simply massive. I think I misspoke saying over 300. It's 658. But there's Gary. That's your brother.
Well, my sister, my brother, and I were really close. We lost our parents when I was 16. My dad was killed when I was 18 when the nurse gave him 100 times a dose of chemotherapy. So my sister, my brother, and I were really, really tight, and the loss of my brother was devastating. So what we did is we tried to turn his memory into something fundamental. So we started the Cantor Fitzgerald Relief Fund, which my sister runs, so she could touch each of the families. And my sister wears a necklace of a broken heart around her neck, and she connects with all of the other families. And then I just tried to raise as much money as I possibly could, trying to piece this smashed company back together again to take care of the families of those we lost. And I was able to talk to them and I was able to communicate with them because I was just one of them. So I always felt that my way of communicating with the families was really on standing on my brother's shoulders. His being part of that group allowed me to talk to them, allowed me to build a community with them, allowed me to rebuild this company. And now we have 12,000 employees. And we are an incredible organization that is built really on the shoulders of my brother and his voice.
So that's the personal and the professional part of Howard Lutnick on this 20-year anniversary. But then there's the average American. You and I are both average Americans. We both had a profound experience on that day, and then we deal with this anniversary every year. Do you look at this day, 20 years later, and say, where are we? Have we backslid? Are we any better? Did we become better? Did we squander any of that beautiful national unity that we had in the ensuing months and years after 9/11? Like, where's your headspace when it comes to who we are as a nation?
That day I was uptown with my son dropping into kindergarten, and then I went right down to the building to try to see if I could help. And I was literally standing underneath the North Tower when the South Tower collapsed. So I was literally engulfed in that black and felt just like you did. Only I was unfortunately right underneath it and thought I had died from that black. And so I felt really strongly that we should go and get the bad guys. And I was really excited that the American military went out and sought to avenge what happened to us and to protect us, create homeland security, and do all these things to make us better. And now it's 20 years later, and I think we all say never forget, but I sort of feel like it's fading. That we're not protecting ourselves against terrorists in the same way we did before because it's 20 years and people just let it slide a little bit. So I feel like the world is forgetting a little bit, and it is allowing terrorists to sort of grow and build, and it's tough. it's tough to be 20 years later and to feel like we're not as vigilant, we're not as strong, we're not protecting ourselves as much as I thought we would do. But I guess that's just human nature.
Well, then there's the other side of it too, right? As I'm assuming every year after 9/11, you know, some networks played the whole broadcast day. They would replay it. And I don't know for you, but for me, it was really hard. I couldn't watch it. And so I almost strangely, paradoxically welcomed the dwindling of news coverage. But when you put it in those words, now I feel bad for, you know, not just sort of pushing through it, weathering through it. Do you sometimes feel, please, I don't need to see another story. It's too painful.
Well, I would agree with you. Of course, it feels that way. And when I see those pictures, even when I'm watching your program and I see those pictures, you know, it causes my insides to just sort of rip apart, because when that first plane hit that first tower, those are my friends. You know, that's my brother. That's my best friend. We had a rule at the company. We only want to work with people that we like. So when we'd interview people, we would decide, are these people going to be our friends? Because we spend more time with people we work with than often you spend with your family. And so these were all of our friends, and it's ripping. But what I try to do is keep my head down. We have this spectacular charity day where all of my employees, they waive their day's pay. And we ask our clients to do as much business as they can. We have celebrities come and help us. And we've raised on average $12 million a year, which we give to about 150 different organizations, because that's a good way for me to spend my day. You know, I can't figure out how otherwise to spend my day. Otherwise, I just want to stick my head under the pillow or stick it in an oven. One of those two.
I completely understand and I fully concur. And you know what? I like interviewing people I like. So I'm glad that you were here today. Thanks for doing this.
Well, thanks for all you do and what you put up with that day and what David did. Those were incredible stories, and being down there with you that day was, it never comes out of you. You know, it's just in you, and you knew what happened to the people in the building. And, it's just, you just want to remember them and keep them alive in your hearts.
Like I said, I can't tell you enough how much I appreciate this on this, very sad anniversary, but also very eye-opening for us as we look forward. Thanks, Howard.
Thank you.
When we come back, the post 9/11 generation, they are making their own connections to the events that shaped the world that we've left them. So how do you feel about the world we've left them? And how do you suppose they feel about it, especially when it comes to our behavior as adults? That's next.
I hope I live. It's coming down on me. Here it comes. I'm getting behind a car. It's incredible. Okay, I'm gonna have to go find people who need help, because I don't think I'm one of them.
It was a cameraman recounting his moments as he was able to film the event as it happens. Welcome back to this very special edition of Banfield. My next guests weren't even born when terror came to America in a way that most of us could never have imagined. And now it's really just through imagination and, of course, the insights of their parents and teachers that the post 9/11 generation connects with the not so distant past and then also inspires their peers. I am pleased now to welcome two students at Allen Community College in Iowa, Kansas, Adrian Nading and Blake Hess. Both are 19 years old. They're taking part in a production of a one-act play that was written by a 9/11 survivor. The play is called Bystander 9/11. Guys, it's really good of you to join me. Thank you. Sometimes I can't believe that there's a generation who doesn't know anything about what we grown-ups have lived through. And I would love to just sort of tap your brain as to what America is to you. You know, you've never taken your shoes off, or you've always had to take your shoes off, you know, at the airport, and you could never rush for a last-minute flight and get on board, you know, getting to the airport 15 minutes before. Those are some of the superficial things, but how do you sort of compare your America to what you think our America is?
I mean, it's one of those things where people talk about how things were different before, but I guess
I don't have a sense of how things were before. People had to get used to a new normal, but I was born into that new normal.
Yeah. And Adrian, I suppose that the fact that you're doing this play on 9/11, and it truly is the personal account of the playwright. He was going to work that day, and you know, he decided to write this play because he feels like 9/11 is just this collection of pictures to everybody, and it's not the personal experience that each of us went through. So you guys and every other actor over the years who, you know, who've done this play, you're kind of living his life in a way, aren't you?
Yeah, we're telling a story. I don't like thinking of it as acting because, in a way, we're just sharing his story. We're sharing his experience of that night, that day.
Yeah. And Blake, when you read the play for the first time, you know, prepping to, you know, perform it, did you learn something? Did you think, geez, I've been watching the news all these years. I didn't know it was like this on 9/11.
I mean, it's like one of those things, like, I've heard the stories since, like, you know, every day at school when that day comes around, you know, I expect to, you know, hear about it when that day rolls around. But then, like, I guess reading something more personal, I guess, gave me a new perspective.
Did it hurt, Adrian? Like, when you started performing it and sort of living the reality of the playwright, did you get the lump in your throat that I get every 9/11? I hate to say it, but, and I should say the author of the play is Maren Langster. I hope I'm pronouncing it right, Maren Langster. Did you get the lump in your throat thinking, God, this is what he went through? This is what all of those people went through.
Yeah, for sure. We definitely get that. We actually had to do a lot of research into 9/11 and the events that happened that day. And so we not only have to experience that while we're on stage, but we went through and we watched a lot of documentaries and videos, and we've actually talked to a few other survivors about it. So I really have felt, I feel more connected to it now than what I did before we started the play.
Well, I for one, having, you know, been under that North Tower when it came down, I'm really happy that you are, you know, digging so deep into this and doing something to commemorate 9/11, but also, you know, informing yourselves of the realities of that day. It seems almost like a weird memory for me too. So, you know, Blake, the one question I have for your generation is, did we screw you up? Like, did we leave a crappy country behind? I think about those images you've had to look on January 6th with all those people storming the Capitol and beating up police officers and all the people screaming at each other in political rallies and the cable news that yells at each other and tells us all we're idiots if we're on the other side. I would love to know if you're mad at us for creating this world for you in the last 20 years, or if you feel like you've got a really good country, or you've got a good system, or you've got a good America. What are your thoughts?
I would say that things are a mess right now, but I guess I am just still hopeful for the future. And I think doing this play, I'm hearing it's definitely also a story about how people came together. And so, like, I guess I'm aware that the possibility of people coming together exists, even when I see all the division around me right now.
I'll tell you what, I'll second that, because in New York City, the last thing that would happen when you walked into an elevator is someone would say hello to you. That was unheard of. You would be crazy to talk to a stranger. But on 9/12, everybody talked to each other. And usually the first thing out of your mouth was, are you okay? Is your family okay? Total strangers would talk to each other. So I hear you. That exists in us. Adrian, just one last comment to you. Do you feel like we can get there again? Can we be a unified country? Can your generation take the baton and do better than we've done?
I don't want to say yes or no, because I feel like your generation did a lot for us too, as a unified, like, group. I feel like if we keep going in the right directions, we definitely can be better as a unified United States in general. So I definitely feel like, in a way, if we keep it up and we keep, like, caring about other people and we talk to people about everything happening in the world, that we're not going to be, like, separated. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally does. And I'm very appreciative that you guys shared this with me. It's good to have this conversation. I need to have more of them. So Adrian, Nadine, and Blake Hess, thank you so much for being with us on this show. I really appreciate it. And good luck to you with the play.
Thank you.
In the aftermath of 9/11, you know, we literally wore our love and gratitude for first responders on our backs, on our t-shirts, on our coffee mugs, everything we could find, shirts, caps, jackets emblazoned with NYPD and Fire Department of New York and others. So what happened to all of that goodwill for officers in the last 20 years? I'm going to ask with two people who survived the carnage that day. They wear that as a job. NYPD and FDNY. Back after a moment.
I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people... And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
The buck may have stopped with the man on the bullhorn there, but tending to the hurt and the dead and the terrified, that fell to the first responders. Among the 2,753 people who were killed in New York on that day, 343 were firefighters and paramedics. 60 were police officers, either with the NYPD or the Port Authority Police. My next guests led the search and rescue teams in the aftermath. Ed Mullins is a 39-year NYPD veteran. He's also president of the Sergeants Benevolent Association. Pete Panuccio is a retired NYPD sergeant who barely escaped 7 World Trade Center with his life. And if you'll remember, that was the building that was collapsing behind me during that live report on MSNBC that we played at the top of the show. Welcome to both of you, and thank you very much for joining me on this very auspicious occasion. Ed, can I begin with you? I look at this 20-year anniversary. I try to look at it in a very big way, and all I can think of is how there was no more glorified person in America than an NYPD officer or a Fire Department of New York firefighter. And 20 years later, it's so different. Talk to me about the change in how America views people like you, NYPD and police officers in general.
Well, on September 10th, 20 years ago, NYPD, you know, cops across America were not looked at as the heroes that they actually became on September 11th. September 11th changed the world. It changed this country, it changed the city of New York. It also changed the way people looked at police and fire. And right after that, it was almost as if a police officer could do no wrong. We're here 20 years later, and policing hasn't changed drastically. We've improved with technology, we've improved with training, but what has changed is people. People have changed from 20 years ago in the regard that I think a lot of people forget, and a lot of people were not around when 9/11 occurred. And I can see the difference today as America lets its guard down from terrorism. You know, my two sons flew on a plane shortly after 9/11, and they were searched at 5 years old. I never experienced that in my life. And every child from, you know, 20 years ago through today is doing the same thing. So we have a different view of the world. We have a different generation. And I don't think there's the appreciation for what this country offers. I don't think there's the appreciation for the police and how they keep America safe. And we have our military that keeps America safe on foreign lands. And messaging has changed. The media has changed. The media doesn't tell the true story of what occurs. They take a segment of what a police officer does, they show a 5-second video, and they paint police officers across the country with a negative brush. And they forget about 9/11. They forget about all the good things that police officers do on a daily basis.
So, Pete, I want you to dovetail on that, and I want to take you back to the first Mets home game in New York, where the field was filled with first responders, the honor and the tributes and the adulation. For you, who survived 9/11, seeing that, seeing those images of all those first responders being cheered and adored, I can only imagine, you know, what it was like because you were suffering. You'd lost so many friends and colleagues. And at the same time, there was just this outpouring of love. I think that the Mets and even the Yankees, they wore NYPD ball caps and FDNY ball caps and sanitation department ball caps against league rules because it was so important to have moments like this, because it was so important to honor you. Talk to me about those mixed emotions back then and what it was like to go through that.
At the time, it was incredibly hard. I lost 19 friends in the tower collapses that morning. And you see the outpouring. People came out to support us. Guys like myself at that time and other cops and firefighters, a lot of us were still at the Trade Center, and we stayed there for months. Doing site security, searching for victims. But it was just an absolutely incredible outpouring of love, and it was good to see. I'm actually having a hard time talking about it. You know, we're here 20 years later. I retired last year, and it was 39 years I did in the police department. I loved it. I loved being a New York City cop. I love those cops in that picture right there. They're from the 19th precinct. The lady, female officer kneeling down, Joanne Dowd, one of the most exceptional cops I've ever seen, as well as the other officers in that photo. And, you know, you talk about the children of 9/11. Joanne Dowd was severely hurt that day. She blew a knee out. We were down at 11 o'clock that night. She absolutely refused to be evacuated until we all left together. And when she went to get her leg fixed, they told her, we have a problem. You're pregnant. And, you know, that was, I guess, one of the blessings. But I work with some truly wonderful people. And you know, and the New Yorkers, of course, the nation, people supported us. It was absolutely amazing.
You know what?
Different times retiring.
Just such an amazing, amazing story. Hold that thought. I have to squeeze in one quick break, but I'm going to be back right after this.